From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore some of the messaging and rhetoric from last week's Republican National Convention. The Daily Show's Ronnie Chang shares some of what he loves about Milwaukee and Wisconsin.
I love visiting American cities, famous American cities. Milwaukee's a famous American city, you know? I heard of it before I even moved to America.
We'll head to the International Crane Foundation to learn how they're caring for the state's rebounding crane population.
Because a species is doing well, that doesn't mean that we should be like, okay, we're done. We can ignore this now and we can move on to something else, because you turn your back and something might happen, something that would cause a decline in the species.
Plus, we'll have the latest episode of Live at Lake Effect featuring Milwaukee musicians Amanda Huff and Steve Peplin. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Last week at the Republican National Convention, there were calls for unity among politicians and pundits alike. The change in messaging was connected with the assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump. But the efforts to focus on a united country were often overshadowed by the divisive rhetoric that has come to define the Republican Party in recent years. From the stage at Pfizer Forum to the convention fest just outside, far-right talking points about the dangers of immigrants and LGBTQ plus people were shared alongside the unity messaging. Peter Montgomery is a senior fellow at Right Wing Watch, a publication that explores and explains far-right ideologies. He was in town for the convention, which is when he chatted with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and X-Grid Nunez.
What are some of the earmarks or characteristics of far-right rhetoric?
I think some of them are divisiveness, othering. You have real Americans and you have these other people. Some of the rhetoric I've heard this week, they're coming for your children. Tucker Carlson said at the Heritage Foundation Policy Fest that the left wants to kill Christians, that that's who your opponents is. He's telling the people that they want to kill Christians. I mean, that's really pretty stunning to hear that kind of rhetoric at a time when supposedly the party is moving to unify the country. That's some of it. I think this rhetoric we've often seen around reproductive choice, that people who support reproductive choice are baby killers and are support infanticide. We see it around some of the rhetoric opposing LGBTQ equality. I heard some of this at the Moms for Liberty event, that people who do that are groomers and pedophiles and everything else. So that kind of rhetoric, I think there's a real gaslighting going on at this convention about who really uses demonization rhetoric, which is a hallmark of Trump and the MAGA movement and a lot of his supporters. And yet they're claiming to be the victims of it. It's pretty astonishing.
When we look at the variety of speakers we've had at this convention, it is interesting just to see the different ideas that are being spewed. What is the rhetoric that's coming specifically from the speaker's stage at the RNC that is really indicative of some of these far-right ideologies?
One of the things that has happened because of the attack on President Trump, the attempted assassination, is that the rhetoric around him being divinely anointed has just been amped up. We've been hearing that from the religious right since 2016 campaign, that he was chosen by God, that he's anointed to lead the country. I mean, we had so many speakers from the main stage say that he was spared by God's direct intervention, that he's on a divine mission from God, basically. And so, you know, what does that make of his political opponents? That means you're God's enemy, right? You're fighting God. You're not just fighting Trump and his agenda. There's also been a tremendous amount of demonization of immigrants and immigration, happy, smiling people waving signs, mass deportation now. Some of the vibe and the energy around that has been pretty disturbing.
And so how is this move toward far-right extremism showing up in the RNC's official platform? We know that they voted on that earlier this week.
Well, just to continue a little bit on the religious rhetoric that we've been talking about, one of the things in the platform is a call for a federal task force to deal with supposed discrimination, harassment, and persecution against Christians in America. That idea that somehow Christians in America, who are the majority of this country, have always been majority politically dominant demographic, are somehow the subject of this vicious persecution is, I think, just inherently not true. but it's part of this politics of grievance, of stirring up fear and anger in order to motivate people to make political gain. I think it's dangerous, but I think we're hearing a lot of that, and that's directly from the platform. Also, the platform talks about the election process of having been very corrupt. It doesn't explicitly say that the election was stolen from Trump, but that kind of language certainly indicates it. You know, the platform calls for various restrictions on voting, various things to make it harder to vote, which I think is, again, part of the anti-democratic nature of the platform of the Project 2025 agenda, which is basically a 900-page version of the platform. And so those are a couple examples.
As we look at the official platform of the RNC, you mentioned this idea of grievance politics, but of course, inside of the official platform, they have a lot of ways that they plan to directly persecute people in the United States. This is really with the backdrop of anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric. They specifically say inside of the platform, Republicans will end left-wing gender insanity. Can you contextualize that statement for us? Because I think people could understand that a variety of ways, depending on their beliefs.
Gender ideology, gender insanity, all that language is deployed to, you know, oppose the advance of LGBTQ equality, and particularly as part of the campaign to purge libraries and schools of books or curriculum that promote understanding or tolerance or even just acknowledgement of the existence of LGBTQ people. And it has become one of the main culture war strategies of the right to demonize particularly trans people. The right knows that they basically lost the battle for the hearts and minds of Americans on gay people, because Americans by two-thirds support marriage equality. Trans people are a lot harder for more people to understand. It's a newer movement. And so they have identified that as a weakness, and they're going at it as hard as they possibly can to make trans people seem weird, to make allies of trans people seem like groomers and child molesters and people who are mutilating kids. Again, it's this very violent rhetoric that's used to describe people who just want to help kids get through their adolescence. You know, we even have states that are criminalizing parents who are supporting their kids. So, you know, that kind of gender insanity, gender ideology is an attempt to totally otherize a group of people that many Americans probably don't understand well or don't have a lot of direct interaction with.
Earlier, you spoke to Project 2025. We both spoke to some delegates about Project 2025, and they were all a bit cagey about it, kind of saying there's no association between Trump and Project 2025. You know, Heritage Foundation is the organization behind this platform, and they have historically had a relationship with the Republican Party. I know they are one of the big sponsors of the RNC. And you kind of alluded to this, but is it your expectation that Project 2025 is the platform of the GOP?
Project 2025 is absolutely the operating platform of the GOP and of the broader right-wing movement that has mobilized to put Trump back in power. It is an astonishing amount of gaslighting that is going on at this convention around Project 2025, and even by Donald Trump trying to disavow it and pretend he doesn't know what it was. This is something that was written by his former aides, people who are prepared to come back into positions of power in the administration. They laid out what they're going to do when he gives them that power. And I think it was really their arrogance that they felt like they could just put it all out there, 900 pages, every right-wing fever dream of what they could do if they had the power and the support of a president who's willing to bend the rules, break the rules, and use power aggressively. That's part of this. It's they want to give him authoritarian power to fire tens of thousands of federal employees by executive order, restripping them of their civil service protections, replace them with loyalists who will do what he says unquestioningly, and, you know, just get rid of the checks and balances. And on top of that, they named J.D. Vance the vice president. J.D. Vance is very close to Heritage. He's praised Project 2025, and he has shown that he shares Trump's worst authoritarian impulses. He has talked about firing all these civil servants and said directly that if the courts intervene, Trump should just ignore them. He should ignore the Supreme Court. I mean, I think it's the combination of the push for an authoritarian, dictatorial presidential control over the executive branch, along with this deep policy to gut federal agencies of their ability to protect Americans from corporate wrongdoing, from polluters. That really makes Project 2025 so scary.
There is this interesting dichotomy that has emerged in which Republicans, especially in light of the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, are supposedly calling for unity, but then are still espousing these beliefs that people should be fired based on their political beliefs, based on any of their personal beliefs that might contradict what the Republican Party believes. Do you anticipate this idea of unity extending beyond the convention? And what does that really look like for a party that, you know, many of their beliefs are based on divisiveness?
I think it's just a shameless ploy to take advantage of the unfortunate assassination attempt on Donald Trump. I don't think the Republican Party has any intention of giving a unity message between now and the election. I don't think Donald Trump does, but he's who he is. And even if he was changed somewhat by that experience, he is who he is. He is not a uniter. He has built his entire campaign and political career on brutally dividing people, on demonizing his opponents, on cruelty and mocking and all those things. That's who he is. And we saw that from the other speakers. Even while they were saying that we're going to unify the country, we had speaker after speaker demonizing opponents, demonizing immigrants. That's who the MAGA Republican Party is in the age of Trump. In the same way that they're gaslighting around this word unity, there's huge gaslighting going on around the idea of the word freedom. They keep talking, we're the party of freedom, we're the party of freedom. I heard that again at the Moms for Liberty. So on one hand, at Moms for Liberty, you had people saying, we're the party of freedom. And then you had Ron DeSantis talking about how proud he was, not only that he is telling K-12 schools what they can teach, but that he's telling public colleges and universities what they can teach. The freedom lovers who want to take books out of libraries, the freedom lovers who want to strip women of any ability to control their reproductive life and families to make those kind of decisions, who want to reverse the gains toward full equality that have been made by LGBTQ people. This is not a party that loves freedom. Donald Trump and his fans talk about how much they love Viktor Orban, strongman in Hungary, who has crushed the media, who has crushed civil society, who was not in line with him. Donald Trump has threatened to go after media outlets that criticize him. This is not freedom. And yet they present themselves as freedom lovers. Project 2025 has a telling thing from in the introduction by the president of the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts, where he says, freedom is not the freedom to do what you want. It's the freedom to live as you ought. And that is so telling. That's like, well, we're for freedom for you Americans if your idea of freedom is the same as ours, if your idea of how you should live is the same as our particular interpretation of the Bible. That's what they mean by freedom.
The idea that you have the freedom to be exactly who I want you to be.
Absolutely. And that is hardly the American way.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
Peter Montgomery is the Research Director for People for the American Way and Senior Fellow with Right Wing Watch. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and Xgrit Nunez. Montgomery was in town for the Republican National Convention. At WUWM.com, you can find all of our coverage of the RNC in Milwaukee. The Daily Show was supposed to come to Milwaukee during last week's RNC, but following the assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump, the shows were canceled. The Daily Show host Jon Stewart addressed the cancellation, saying their venue, the Marcus Performing Arts Center, was moved inside the hard security perimeter.
You really don't want to be in the hard perimeter. it was locked down. They built cages around the theater, and because of that, we felt that we could not logistically put on the theater shows effectively without people.
While the security perimeter wasn't ever changed, a Marcus spokesperson said it was discussed. Nevertheless, the show went on, just not here in Milwaukee. Before the shows were canceled, Lake Effect Sam Woods spoke with Ronnie Chang. He's on The Daily Show's news team. They talked about navigating the current political landscape and some of the best things about Wisconsin.
The unknowns of election years can be stressful. How do you find the humor in it all?
The jokes are pretty easy, to be honest. The Daily Show has been going on for what is almost 20 years now. So the jokes will be there. I think the way to elevate the comedy is to have a good point of view, you know, versus just doing kind of like America's Funniest Home Videos, but for politics. Not to be cast aspersions against America's Funniest Home Videos. Love that show. Grew up with it. Bob Saget. All my good friends, my heroes. But I think when we do The Daily Show, the difference, because I think it's pretty easy, I think, to show a silly clip and then make some jokes about it afterwards, you know. That's kind of quite bread and butter for comics and for anyone, really, whether you're a professional comic or not. I think where we add to culture and comedy is when we have we can tie it all together with a point of view. I think that's the real skill. So the jokes are, I don't want to jinx myself, relatively easy. The other stuff is a bit harder.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have any suggestions for those of us who aren't professional comedians in finding that either that levity or that humor in?
No, I don't. Like, good luck. Don't do it. If you're not a professional, don't do it. You'll get angry.
As part of The Daily Show, you've done a lot of interviews out in the field where you speak with, you know, politicians, subject matter experts, voters, kind of runs the gamut. And yep. You're
a couple of crazy people.
Yeah. Throw them in a little spice. Yep. But both you and the other correspondents in The Daily Show, your answers make it seem like you're prepared for all the things that might be said. And it might be that distance that you were talking about. But I'm curious, has anyone you've interviewed said something to you that truly just left you speechless?
Yes and no. The thing with these the field pieces that we do, everyone goes into the field pieces with eyes wide open. You know, they know what's going on. We know what's going on. No one's being tricked. So in that sense, there are no surprises. Have they said stuff that made me laugh out loud? Yeah, definitely. But in terms of really shocking, no, we prepare for it. So we kind of know what they're going to say. I mean, I interviewed a couple of white supremacists. Some of the stuff they said was quite funny, but I knew they were going to go along that line. I mean, okay, I guess fair to say I was still shocked when I heard the words come out of their mouth on camera. But was I surprised by what they were saying? Not really. I kind of knew what their point of view was, and they knew what their point of view was, and there was no surprises there.
Yeah, you can't really be surprised when a white supremacist says white supremacist things, right?
Exactly. We're not going to clutch our pearls at that moment. I think it's pretty clear what their point of view is. So I guess what is surprising is sometimes when you hear them justify, you know, something that I personally feel cannot really be justified, and they, when someone justifies a quite extreme position, I guess that's always a little surprising how they manage to justify, and sometimes they are unable to justify, which is where the comedy comes from.
So you've been to Wisconsin and Milwaukee before.
Yes.
While on tour. Before you visited, do you remember what you expected to find when you first came here?
Yes, I expected to find heavy drinking, middle of America people. And what I found was very happy and friendly, heavy drinking, middle of America people. The happiness and friendliness was, I did not quite expect. But what I loved about it, first of all, was that everyone's drinking in someone's basement. Like, all the bars in Milwaukee look like they are just someone's house, just the basement of some guy's house. So it has a very warm, friendly vibe, first of all. It's like a warm dive bar. And second of all, I get the history. I mean, first it's Germans who came. And then it's also, I guess the lake was kind of polluted. So the only way you could have safe drinking water is to have a little bit of beer, you know? So I get it, you know? I get the reasoning behind why people are drinking it. So I didn't come in judging, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, that comes across. I'm curious if you ever tried a Wisconsin old fashioned, one made with bourbon.
No, but I did try what's the Wisconsin beer that you can only get there?
It's probably Spotted Cow, but you might have to be more specific.
Yes, it was Spotted Cow.
Yeah.
Spotted Cow. And the one thing I didn't expect with Milwaukee was great food scene.
Oh yeah.
The food scene was great. I went to Public Market. You know, I'm sure someone out there is yelling at me, or yelling at his radio or AirPods about me mentioning public market. I'm sure there's some kind of like, oh, it's a tourist trap. Hey, I tell you what, Milwaukee public market was great. Downtown Milwaukee, beautiful, spotless. I went to Meet Causes Mini Bowl. I played the mini bowling. Some kid came and we had to pay a kid to reset the pins. I felt awful, but I think that's just how they roll. No one else had a problem. I went to At Random, behind someone's house.
Yep.
And they had, and Milwaukee, somehow you guys perfected ice cream with alcohol. What a obvious cocktail to make that I don't think anyone's ever made. Just a selection of ice cream and alcohol.
Well, I'm glad it sounds like you got off the beaten path a little bit, and that's appreciated. As you know, someone from this state, and, you know, so I understand. You know, you come in here and you have a limited time, but yeah, it's appreciated. You got off the beaten path and made an effort to see the city for what it really is.
Yeah, and I had the sausages. I had the every. You know, I know I made a one of my big thrills is I love visiting American cities, famous American cities. Milwaukee is a famous American city. You know. I heard of it before I even moved to America because of that 70s show and the Milwaukee Bucks. Mm-hmm. So for me, like when I visit around America, it's like visiting movie sets. I'm like, oh, this is the place that, you know, when they yell, I love Wisconsin at the end of the opening theme song for that 70s show. Mm-hmm. This is the Wisconsin that they are referring to.
Yeah. I have a few rapid-fire questions about Wisconsin culture that I'm interested in your thoughts on since you you seem to know a bit about the Badger State. First, tailgates, you might be familiar, are a core piece of Wisconsin sports culture, at least. So the idea of spending, you know, 3 or more hours in a stadium parking lot, of course, with your Wisconsin beer, your brats, your cheese curds, all that. But what would you bring to put the Ronnie Chang stamp on a classic Wisconsin tailgate?
Oh, you know, I'm loving this mixture of Asian and Midwest food. So I would say if you could put some kimchi on a sausage or something, you know, if you could put some, you know, I think the next step of Midwestern food is putting some, you know, fusion spin on it. I think that would go really well. Because, I mean, to be honest, we've all had so many sausages already. I think that's the next step.
Yeah, no, that's good. I can imagine maybe some like roasted garlic spread on top of that, a little bit, maybe some sweet chili sauce. I don't know. That might be a little too daring.
Yeah,
but
No, at all. I mean, look, you guys have had sausages for so long now. You might as well try something new.
Right. Exactly. So I don't know if you're familiar, but about an hour outside of Milwaukee is the Kohler Design Center, where Kohler, the toilet and bathroom appliance company, was founded. And the best way I can describe this place is that it's a mix of the IKEA bathroom section, it's part wine bar and part museum. And so just based on that description, IKEA bathroom section, wine bar, and museum, how would you rate this concept on a scale of 1 to 10?
I would say that sounds like a 10 to me. Dude, I get it, man. I get Milwaukee. I'm down. You know what I mean? What you just described, that's very Milwaukee, and I get it. I'm down for it. It's like that little quirky Americana, you know, European, but make it Milwaukee. That vibe, I get it. I'm down.
Let me push the envelope on your acceptance of Wisconsin traditions here. So are you familiar with cannibal sandwiches?
No.
So essentially they are raw beef spread on a bread, it's like a slice of bread, like a rye bread or a cracker, usually topped with raw onion and you know, your choice of seasoning. So do you have any interest in trying this delicacy when you're in town?
Okay. You know, when I said that I'm down for Milwaukee stuff, I think that's where I have to draw the line.
That's fair.
That is what the hell is that? Is that like beef tartare, but make it Midwestern? Like raw beef and on bread?
I think that's the idea. I get the sense that it's like something someone tried once and like didn't die and then just kept doing it. And I believe it also is tied to the German heritage of the city. It came over with German immigrants in the 1800s, is my understanding.
Okay. I get it, but not that.
No, that's probably good for your health. Another big piece of Wisconsin culture that I learned when I moved here is the concept of a cheese drawer. And so that is a drawer in your fridge that is reserved for cheese. And I didn't even really like cheese all that much before I moved here. And then slowly it kind of won me over. And I have a cheese drawer where it just I happen to have cheese on deck at any moment. And I'm curious, do you have a cheese drawer?
No, I don't have a cheese drawer. I love cheese, but compared to people in Wisconsin, I'm just a rookie.
Well, Ronnie Chang, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks for speaking with me.
Ronnie Chang is a comedian, actor, and a senior correspondent on The Daily Show's news team. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods. Coming up later in the show, we'll have the latest Live at Lake Effect featuring Milwaukee duo Amanda Huff and Steve Peplin. But first, we'll learn all the ways the International Crane Foundation is working to protect the world's 15 crane species. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've explored Wisconsin's wetlands, you've probably come across one of two tall birds, the sandhill crane or the whooping crane. Sandhill cranes were on the brink of extinction just a century ago. Now, there's over 100,000 of them, and nearly half call Wisconsin home. Studying this rebound has helped the International Crane Foundation also restore the whooping crane's population in North America. However, they're still an endangered species with about 800 of the birds in the world. For this month's Chirp Chat, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with Ann Lacey, the director of the Eastern Flyway Programs for the International Crane Foundation. She explains the challenges cranes face and what the ICF is doing to help.
There are two crane species here in Wisconsin. Can you tell me a little bit more about the sandhill crane?
The sandhill crane is the most numerous of the 15 crane species in the world. They exist throughout North America, down into Mexico even. And technically they're an Asian species too, because some of the birds that fly through the central flyway go all the way through Canada, across Alaska, across the Bering Sea, and nest in Siberia. So it's a long way. That's a really, really long way. So there are multiple flyways for sandhill cranes. And here in Wisconsin, we have the eastern population, and ours migrate generally southeast. They can go all the way to Florida, but often will stop in Indiana or Kentucky, Alabama, Georgia. There's probably 1.5 million sandhill cranes occurring in North America. There's over 100,000 sandhill cranes in the eastern population, so the ones that come through here in Wisconsin and breed here in Wisconsin. And of the eastern population, maybe not quite half of that population is resident in Wisconsin.
Wow.
So this is definitely the breadbasket of cranes in Wisconsin. And, you know, famously, Aldo Leopold wrote a marshland elegy in, you know, the 1930s. And he thought that he was going to see the demise of the sandhill crane in his lifetime. And luckily he did not. It was already starting a very, very slow recovery even before he died. But I kind of wonder what he would think of the sandhill crane population now. Because probably more sandhill cranes now in Wisconsin than there were, you know, pre-European settlement and, you know, the transformation of the landscape. But sandhill cranes are generalists. And so they really took to prairies being converted into agricultural lands. And it's either luck or good foresight to keep many of our historic wetlands. And Wisconsin has about 50% of its historic wetlands. And of course, cranes are obligate wetland nesters. And that really helped with the recovery as well. So,
can you tell me about ICF's efforts and how they helped recover sandhill crane populations?
By the time the International Crane Foundation started in 1973, the sandhills were well on their way to recovery. So it was really a focus on other crane species worldwide that were in grave danger of going extinct, the whooping crane being one here in North America, but there's other crane species that at that time we really didn't even know the status. we did want to study the Santo crane because it helped inform us about other species. But because a species, crane or otherwise, is doing well, that doesn't mean that we should be like, okay, we're done. We can ignore this now and we can move on to something else, because you turn your back and something might happen, something that would cause a decline in the species. And species like cranes that are long-lived but slow to reproduce, once it starts a decline, what caused it has been happening for long enough that it might be too difficult to stop that momentum. And so that's why I love that we are studying the sandhill cranes here in Wisconsin, because we do not want that to happen again.
Is it true that people here dress up as cranes to help maintain populations?
Well, they do dress up as cranes. For our whooping crane work, our aviculturists here and in other captive centers that we work with, we don a crane costume, but it is not to look like cranes. It is to cover the human form. And so on one arm, they have a crane puppet, and that looks like the head of a whooping crane. And that's really what we want the chicks that they're raising to focus on. And so that is very specific to reintroduction, because we don't have enough whooping cranes in captivity that can raise a whooping crane for release out into the wild. And the birds, of course, in the wild, unfortunately, are not self-sustaining yet. So we need to raise birds in captivity and keep amending these populations until we get to a point where they are self-sustaining. And a good way to do that is to raise many chicks at once with human caretakers. And we don't want them to imprint on people. So when we put them out in the wild, they act like wild birds. And they do. And they do. So it's kind of weird. But it is really ingenious. And that just kind of really makes a great point about the ingenuity that it takes to recover a species and the lengths that we go to. You know, famously, these birds were taught the migration route from Wisconsin down to Florida by an ultralight plane. That is really some creative thinking, and it absolutely worked. And now we have birds that are flying all the time, and we can release these birds that we raise now into the company of adult birds to follow down and learn that route.
What are some challenges that sandhill cranes and whooping cranes are facing in Wisconsin today?
The biggest challenge to our Wisconsin population is themselves and the crop damage that they do. But we helped a manufacturer develop a deterrent to keep cranes from damaging sprouting corn seeds, because they will go in and they will pluck out the corn seeds as they're sprouting. And they can do a lot of damage to a cornfield. And that's an economic hit that doesn't matter, good times or bad. It's not good. And so we helped develop this seed treatment, and it works. It's very effective. It takes that one thing off the menu. You know, cranes, again, are omnivores, and we just don't want you eating that one thing. You can eat the bugs and the waste grain, and there's tons of other things in a field for them to eat. It's also very, very difficult to convince a crane that they don't want to be there. If it's a territorial pair, especially with a chick, they cannot go anywhere. Non-breeding flocks, which can do the most damage, they're kind of meandering about the landscape. But you also don't want to scare them away and make it a problem for your neighbors or another field that you own. And so a lot of the work that we do, you know, just knowing cranes and their ecology really helped inform this effective solution. But thinking specifically to whooping cranes right now, the biggest hurdle is figuring out the impediments to them breeding successfully. There's lots of reasons that a young chick would not make it. There's disease issues. Again, genetics, you never know when a bad gene is going to rear its head, and they just literally have failure to thrive. But we have a lot of predators here in Wisconsin, avian and mammal of varying sizes. And so right now, that is still our biggest hurdle, is figuring out what is keeping the wild population that is established in Wisconsin from breeding. We have a lot of pairs that are well established. They nest year after year, and they can't quite seem to have their chicks survive the 100 days it takes to fledge. Once they fledge, then the survival probability goes way up, because, of course, they can fly away from things, and it just makes them a lot safer. So that's a really big focus for us right now.
Absolutely. Well, and at the end of every Chirp Chat, I ask my guests to highlight a bird, in this case, a crane.
So when I'm asked what my favorite crane is, I say, oh, I don't have a favorite, but I do, of course. And it's a Santo crane. That was my gateway crane, and it's my favorite one. But since I have been working at the Crane Foundation and had the distinct pleasure of working with other crane species in other parts of the world where they exist, I have such a special appreciation for the blue crane. And here's the crossover special. The blue cranes that we have here on site are raising a Santo crane chick.
Oh my gosh.
So they're extra special right now. And so it's just wonderful to watch them be new parents and raising a Santo crane chick.
Well, let's head over and check them out.
Let's do that.
So, and we are here at the Blue Crane exhibit. We are keeping our voices a little low because who do we have nearby?
We are so close to Periwinkle and Howard, and they are our male and female blue crane pair, and they are meandering through the lovely prairie plants in their exhibit looking for food items for their little chick that they're taking care of. And I can't believe how close we are. So precious.
And who's the little chick?
The chick is Calypso. And Calypso is a Santo crane chick. But when it hatched out of its egg and was placed in with Howard and Periwinkle, they didn't know that it wasn't their egg. They had been sitting on an egg that was infertile. So we're encouraging this pair and their parental activities. And so that's building their confidence as a pair, in hopes that someday they will have a fertile egg of their own. But part of that was we happened to have a Santo crane egg here on site that was fertile, and the timing was right for hatching for these guys, and we knew that practice makes perfect, and practicing with a Santo crane is acceptable. So they will be parents and are teaching this Santo to be a crane, but so it doesn't learn to be a blue crane, Calypso will be moved later this summer to a Santo crane enclosure, so it will be able to hang out next to a real Santo crane. And eventually it will go to another captive center where it will be an ambassador for his Santo crane species someplace else.
Ann Lacey is the director of Eastern Flyway Programs in North America for the International Crane Foundation. She spoke with Like Effects' Exgrit Nunez for a monthly series we call Chirp Chat. At WUWM.com, you can hear more of this conversation and find last month's Chirp Chat all about spark birds. We'll take one more break and then return with the latest Live at Lake Effects session featuring Milwaukee's own Amanda Huff and Steve Peplin. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Live at Lake Effect is our music series featuring artists performing in the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood. We brought the Lake Effects together, along with Visionary Studios, to showcase local and nationally touring musicians. Today we have Milwaukee musicians Amanda Huff and Steve Peplin. The duo have been longtime collaborators and bandmates since 2017. Known for leading the experimental jazz septet, Strangelander. Here they are performing their song, The Star and the Lantern.
All right, this is a tune called The Star and the Lantern, which is going to be the title track of the second Strangelander full-length record.
Care, you find it everywhere. mind, you will have to climb. If you want to climb, you'll have to take the fall. Here upon the road to heaven, ever will you find. Love will always be the answer. Seek and you will find. The star inside the lantern of the mind. If you take my love, would you take it all? If you take my care, it might just seem unfair. Would you give them love, or would you judge their sins? Will you rise above? And you will find the star that burns in the night to guide the long lost souls before the darkness gets too deep and now the ships won't find their way back home. Upon the road to heaven, ever will you find. Love will always be the answer. Seek and you will find. Here upon the road to heaven, never on your mind. You will have to find the star that burns in the night to guide the long lost souls before the darkness gets too deep. The crying chorus of sheep that will take
Hi, this is Audrey Nowakowski from Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. We're here at the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood, along with Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep, who's my fellow Live at Lake Effect co-producer. Hello, Trapper.
Audrey, how are you today?
Doing so well, especially after hearing what we just did.
Yeah, that was a high quality musical performance, if I have ever heard one, from Amanda Huff and Steve Peplin. We are here in the Lake Effect Surf Shop. You have shook this place up. Thank you for being here, both of you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Amanda, when did you realize that you had this monster voice on your hands?
I think when nobody told me to shut up. I don't know. I don't really have any formal training, so a lot of this was just like, you know, singing in the shower, singing in the car, singing in my bedroom, and you know, I didn't get stopped, so it just kept going.
Well, I love that kind of natural growth and just keep going because no one told you otherwise. And you initially came to Milwaukee to study at MIAD for painting. So can you talk a bit about the intersection between visual art and your music and what that means for you personally?
Yeah. I mean, I think like I ended up pursuing art because I was a real artsy kid just doing all the weird stuff. But I always wanted to do music. I just think that because I didn't know anything about it, I didn't think that I could get into a school for it. So I just kind of did it on the side and found out that that was actually really nice to have constant, no rules for music, rules for art. And I could, you know, build my own parameters by cross training those two fields. It was really nice just to be steeped in creatives. I found that to be really inspiring for my music back and forth.
And Steve, you are a bit of a Milwaukee guitar god. I'm just going to say that. You played with everyone from the Milwaukee Symphony to De La Buena. And today you are wearing a lot of hats. You are playing the tambourine on your foot. You are whistling with your mouth, playing guitar. And also you have a really cool contraption that I've never seen before with your guitar pick. Can you explain that briefly? Because in all of my years of playing music, I've never seen someone take out sandpaper with their guitar pick before they've played.
Well, the sandpaper thing is probably born of laziness. You don't have to use as much force to drag the pick across the string. It creates like an abrasive rosin violin bow kind of thing. I was just trying to sound like Miles Davis. Every time he plays a note, it's got sort of that little noise before the note, and that's kind of what I'm going for.
And you've recently put together a book. Can you talk about that?
Well, I wrote a book called Sound Traveler's Atlas, which Amanda actually proofed. And it's kind of just a really weird music book that's kind of focusing on the motives behind being a creative person rather than technical ephemera, like, you know, why Beethoven used a 5-7 or whatever it is. It's more about training and disciplining your mind and trying to stay inspired. So many of my students at MATC and Lawrence seem like they're struggling to be inspired, and I'm just kind of going for that with that book. Thanks for mentioning that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so can you talk about that line between technicality and feel and how you approach that with your students?
I feel that music is all about the feeling. It's like a Starbucks cup. Nobody cares about the logo. It's what's inside of it that matters, you know, and the music is like the cup. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't have the feeling, all bets are off.
So Amanda, you've had to be a musical chameleon in certain ways. And I know you've lent your voice to a few commercial and film projects. So, you know, we're kind of speaking of how being around creatives of all different types helps feed you. So can you share a bit about those experiences? And do you have any other interesting projects in the past or things coming up that lend itself to that?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I think, you know, I also really like to wear many hats. You know, you kind of wake up every day and put a different one on, see how it feels. I really like getting into character play. I find so many different types of music exciting. And so I tend to bounce around different projects. It can get a little confusing sometimes when you're trying to contextualize who you are specifically. But I think, like, at the end of the day, if I can find a way to put myself into each of these boxes, that's like an even bigger, harder win. I do have a lot of exciting projects coming up, though. Some of them I can't speak on yet, but you know, anyone who's looked at my past work, there's something more coming. But right now, my main focus has been my band, You Win, doing stuff with Strangelander again. And I have a new solo project that I've been doing called Lila Realm. And I've been teaching myself how to do my own production to kind of take my voice back into my own hands. And that'll kind of be the debut, whatever that looks like.
We can't wait to hear it. Amanda Huff, Steve Peplin, two incredible Milwaukee talents. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for your kindness.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Milwaukee duo Amanda Huff and Steve Peplin joining us for Live at Lake Effect. Be sure to head to WUWM.com and our YouTube page to see them performing three original songs in the Lake Effect Surf Shop. Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep and myself are the executive producers of Live at Lake Effect. Sound engineering is done by WUWM's Jason Reavy. And thanks to our friends at Visionary Studios, a local advertising agency, for filming and editing this episode. New episodes of Live at Lake Effect are released monthly, and be sure to catch up on our past episodes featuring the Cactus Blossoms, Willie Carlisle, Buffalo Nichols, Abby Jean, and plenty more. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at how the recently updated legislative voting maps will change things for some voters in the upcoming Wisconsin partisan primary. Plus, we'll help you plan a canoeing camping trip down the Wisconsin River in Wandering, Wisconsin. Join us tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. The star that burns in the night.